From Wisconsin Public Radio and Public Radio International, a special series, East Meets West. This hour, Clash of Civilizations.
Is there a clash of ideas going on throughout the world? Absolutely.
What I see here is a clash between these two forces, both of which are trying to remake the world in their own image, and neither of which can really succeed.
But also, Western leaders have said one thing and actually done something totally different.
I'm Jim Fleming. Today, we'll re-examine the idea that we're locked in a clash of civilizations, a kind of death match between Islam and the West. And we'll look back at another great clash of ideologies, the U.S. standoff against Red China.
That's why Nixon going to China has become a sort of catchphrase for a statesman doing something that is bold. It's one of those moments where you remember where you were because it seems so unlikely.
We'll also hear from a Pakistani rock star who's out to reclaim music as part of the Islamic tradition. He says sacred texts do not prohibit music.
There's a rigidity within the clergy and the mullahs, and also they're afraid of losing their gig. They see thousands and thousands of kids going to concerts, and I think they fear that on the Friday sermon, they're going to lose their demographic.
Sometimes it takes fiction to grasp some basic human reactions that shape our politics. Consider Mohsen Hamid's acclaimed novel, The Reluctant Fundamentalist. It's the story of a Princeton-educated Pakistani man who goes to work for a high-powered New York management consulting firm and then gets disillusioned, convinced that he's become an unwitting pawn of American empire.
I was in my room, packing my things. I turned on the television and saw what at first I took to be a film. But as I continued to watch, I realized that it was not fiction but news. I stared as one, and then the other, of the twin towers of New York's World Trade Center collapsed. And then I smiled. Yes, despicable as it may sound, my initial reaction was to be remarkably pleased. But please believe me when I tell you that I am no sociopath. I am not indifferent to the suffering of others. But at that moment, my thoughts were not with the victims of the attack. No, I was caught up in the symbolism of it all, the fact that someone had so visibly brought America to her knees. I understand, of course. It is hateful to hear another person gloat over one's country's misfortune. But surely you cannot be completely innocent of such feelings yourself. Do you feel no joy at the video clips, so prevalent these days, of American munitions laying waste the structures of your enemies?
Mohsen Hamid shares many biographical details with his novel's narrator, Cengiz. He, too, is a Pakistani man who grew up in Lahore, went to school at Princeton, and worked for a high-flying American company. But Hamid told Steve Paulson that there's a crucial difference between him and his fictional creation.
When I was a child, I spent 5 years in America from the ages of 3 till 8 because my father did his PhD there and my family moved here for a few years. And then I returned to Pakistan and then I came to America for college, I stayed for law school and I worked in New York for a while after that. So by the time I started writing this novel, I had lived about half my life in America. I was much more American than Cengiz is in the novel or ever becomes. So my reactions to things, in many ways, are different from Cengiz's. But that said, I think some of Cengiz's reactions are things that I could imagine feeling. And I think sometimes when we were working, and particularly on foreign assignments, and I would think, you know, who am I serving here? And am I really doing something which is for the betterment of other people, beyond just making my company or myself more wealthy?
You left New York, but you went to London. I guess the question is, why have you chosen to settle in England rather than in America?
Well, I'm somebody who's come to believe that we're all torn between things. We can be torn between being, you know, husbands and wives and having sort of sexual identities. We can be torn between being Pakistanis and Americans or whatever our identities are. And the most dangerous thing is if we suddenly pretend that we're just one part of ourselves and try to ignore the other parts of ourselves. I think it's actually important to try to reconcile yourself to all of what you are. For me, London in a strange way allows me to do that because I'm very close to America and I'm very close to Pakistan. outside both, but close to both.
But do you feel more welcomed as a Pakistani, as a man from a Muslim background? Do you feel more welcomed in London than in New York?
To a certain extent, yes, I do feel more welcome. There's less fear, I think, in London and Britain more generally of Muslims and of terrorism, I think, more broadly speaking. Partly this is because there's a history of terrorism and a history of war, and partly it's because I think the media and politicians try to frighten the people of the UK less than they do in the US.
Now, have these perceptions in America changed radically since 9/11?
They have changed radically. I mean, before 9/11, I was, I suppose, a sort of person of color, and that, too, of an intermediate point of sort of, you know, a light brown, not particularly important in America's color divide between the black and the white. But after September 11th, that did change. And for the first time, I experienced what it was like to be part of a, you know, a profiled group that people were actually frightened of. I would spend several hours in the airports, you know, dealing with questions about whether or not I'd had combat training in Afghanistan, you know, to which I replied I was in law school, I didn't have time for any kind of training, let alone combat training. For me, I did not have an American experience which was characterized by racism or crude prejudice, but I do think now there is more suspicion of people like me. But that said, I have to also add that I feel it too. I wrote a piece for the Independent newspaper in London where I talked about sitting on the tube, the subway, next to a guy who looked like me, a Pakistani guy. He had a beard, and he was dressed in ethnic Pakistani clothes, and the seat next to him was empty in a crowded tube carriage. And I thought, you know, this is racial profiling. But when I sat next to this guy, it became clear to me when I started speaking to him that he was mentally unstable. And then I noticed he had this money pouch underneath his shirt, and I thought, oh, my God, he's a suicide bomber. He's going to kill us all. And I had the exact same terrified, panicked reaction anybody else would have. And I realized it isn't a matter of simple racism. It is actually more complicated, and it's underneath all of our skins.
That's Mohsin Hamid, author of the novel The Reluctant Fundamentalist. In the last two decades, no political theory has sparked as much controversy as the idea that we're embroiled in a clash of civilizations. Back in 1993, Samuel Huntington first made this argument, saying a new kind of global conflict had replaced the Cold War, that China and the Islamic world were poised to challenge the core Western values of liberal democracy and pluralism. Many people dismissed Huntington's argument as another bit of Western arrogance, as if other cultures simply aren't capable of creating democracies. And then the Twin Towers at the World Trade Center came crashing down, and Huntington's idea gained new urgency. So are we seeing a clash of civilizations? Steve Paulson asked three prominent intellectuals what they think, and whether large catchphrases like East and West still have meaning.
Hello, my name is Sasha Abramsky. I'm a senior fellow for democracy at the New York-based Demos think tank. Is there a clash of civilizations? My answer to that question is partly yes, partly no. Not in the way that Samuel Huntington believes there is. Not in the sense of a geographic clash of civilizations and cultures. But is there a clash of ideas going on throughout the world, inside countries as well as between countries? Absolutely. Can we control the direction that that clash takes? That's the question that's going to define probably the rest of our lives.
Now, do you see this clash of ideas mainly between Islam and the West, or is it bigger than that?
I think it's far bigger than that. Throughout the world at this point, the Enlightenment has taken root in many cultures. The ideas of science, of rationality, of understanding politics as a rational experience. Many countries now have at least an intellectual elite that believes that. On the other hand, most countries also have people and groups that are very, very scared by those forces. What I think is happening, and I think it's increasingly happened over the last 5, 10, 15 years, there are people within individual countries who view their experiences through an extremist religious lens. It doesn't have to be Islam. It could be Christianity in the Bible Belt in America. It could be Judaism in parts of Israel. It could be Hindu fundamentalism in India. But increasingly, religion is coming to play an organizing role that in decades past has been played by secular organizations and secular political groupings. And I think that's the central clash. It's not necessarily between geographic locations. It's between intellectual mindsets.
So the pre-Enlightenment world is essentially this religious worldview. I mean, even though it plays out differently, depending on which religion you're talking about, you're saying that's the real clash here.
It seems to me that that's the exact clash that we're looking at, that one of the great projects of Enlightenment thinking was the ability to separate out church and state, whether that was formally, as in the United States Constitution, or whether it was culturally, let's say a country like England, which has an established church, the Church of England, but to all practical purposes has a secular apparatus of government. And I think what we're seeing increasingly is the breakdown of that divide. And the reason I think it's too simplistic to say this is a clash of civilizations between Islam and the West, that divide is breaking down as powerfully in a state like Alabama as it is in, let's say, Iran or Afghanistan. The worldview is actually more similar than we might be comfortable acknowledging, that somebody who preaches that the Bible says the be-all and end-all of how the world was created, that the world was created in 7 days, that evolution is this satanic diversion. Someone who preaches that is actually preaching a religion as extreme as the Taliban's. And if you look at the history books, if you look at what happens in moments of extremism like that, whether it's the Crusades, whether it's World War II, where it wasn't religion but it was nationalism run amok, you see that the aftermath is cataclysmic. It always results in tremendous bloodshed. It always results in the collapse of established old cultures and civilizations. It always results in economic disintegration.
Hmm. Well, it's fascinating to hear what you're saying. I mean, partly you're redefining the whole notion of clash of civilizations as something between East and West. I mean, you're saying those categories really don't work anymore. And maybe we should pick that apart a little bit and talk about the West, because, I mean, that still is a very enduring concept. When we talk about the West, we tend to refer to values like liberal democracy as it's played out in Europe and the United States. Is that even worth saying anymore?
The problem is nobody really does a very good job of defining what the West is. And it's possibly because it's an impossibility at this point in time to accurately define the West as an institution or as a single cultural concept. Unlike, let's say, NATO, where you can pinpoint the member states with accuracy because it's a club. Well, who's in the West at this point?
Right. I mean, is Japan a part of the West? I mean, Japan
being
an advanced capitalist nation with an enduring democracy, obviously, geographically, it's not remotely in the West.
You're right. Japan today is an advanced economy. It's an advanced democracy. The other example is Russia. Now, if you go back to Peter the Great's time, Russia defines itself as this rising power designed to transcend East and West. But if you go back a bit further, Russia's a Mongol state, and it's firmly set in the East. If you fast forward to the Soviet times, again, Russia comes to be seen as an Eastern state in opposition to Western values or Western economies. Today, well, it largely depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to a Russian nationalist hostile at the encroachment of NATO, well, Russia's obviously standing in opposition to the West. If you're talking to an Islamic militant in Chechnya, Russia's a part of the satanic West. So it seems to me that geographic definitions of the West, if they ever did make sense, they've really lost their meaning. But going back to your first question, when we're talking about the West, do we really mean democracy, pluralism, liberalism, and so on? Well, if you define the West by Enlightenment values, that's what we mean. On the other hand, if you go back to the Inquisition 500 years, well, the Inquisition is firmly set in the West. In many ways, at that period in history, it defines the West. And the Inquisition is one of the most bloody, intolerant, vicious episodes in European history.
Well, let me ask the question another way then, in terms of trying to come up with a definition of the West. Do we mean something differently now than we did 50 years ago or 100 years ago? Has the definition of the West changed?
Absolutely. If you go back 100 years ago, the West was the locus of naked imperial power, not the sort of now you see it, now you don't imperialism of American foreign policy today, where we have a de facto empire, but we deny it. If you go back 100 years, all the proud great nation states of Western Europe had empires. There was nothing hidden about it. They were the glories of national culture, the English Raj in India, the French possessions in North Africa, the Dutch East Indies, and so on. These were the stuff of national legend. If 100 years ago you were talking about what the West is, You were talking about a proud, expansionist, martial culture. You were also, incidentally, talking about a society which didn't really value universal suffrage. So you only have to go back 100 years. No country in the world allowed women to vote. You go back a little bit further. Most countries didn't have any kind of suffrage. They were essentially aristocracies or monarchies. Ironically, many of the views that would have been championed by leading statesmen 100 years ago in the West are views that today are seen as so quote-unquote retrograde that only an obscurantist from outside the West would dare to espouse them, case in point being women's suffrage. Today, nobody in Western politics is going to advocate denying the right to vote to women. But if you go to Saudi Arabia, women cannot vote. Most of the media in the West would define that as very, very backward. But that was a value that not too long ago would have been a Western value, not allowing women to vote. So if we really want to get a grip on what we're fighting about, what our tensions are about, what the clashes that are emerging are about, we really should move beyond these simplistic definitions of East and West.
Sasha, thank you.
Very welcome.
Sasha Abramsky is a senior fellow for democracy at Demos and author of the book American Furies.
Hi, my name is Lee Harris. I'm author of Suicide of Reason, Radical Islam's Challenge to the Enlightenment. I no longer think the clash of civilizations paradigm is relevant. Let me clarify that. A civilization is a kind of organized whole. The Pax Americana, I think, kind of achieved that for the post-World War II period. And during this stage of civilization where you have one dominant country, the world is fairly predictable. You know what's going to happen. There's a routine. There are no great surprises in history. What has happened recently, especially in the post-9/11 period, is that there have been a multitude of surprises. Things are just not going in a predictable way. The world order that had been fairly stabilized during the Cold War has increasingly disintegrated. It is unraveling as kind of we watch.
Do you think it's unraveled because a new kind of ideology, a new kind of thinking has come onto the world stage that we just weren't ready for?
No, I don't think it's new ideology. To me, it's essential to grasp that there are two clashes here. One is the West, which is at least under the presidency of George Bush, has decided to bring democracy and liberalism to the rest of the world. Now, the problem here is that the rest of the world doesn't really, they see what we call modernization, liberalization, as Westernization. That is, forcing them to become like us. In turn, there's been a kind of revival of an older feeling of tradition, that is, a revival of the Islamic ideal of jihad, of returning to the old traditions. What I see here is a clash between these two forces, both of which are trying to remake the world in their own image, and neither of which can really succeed. And what I fear is in the process of the collision between the two, that what I call a decivilization process will develop. By that I mean more and more ruthlessness will appear, acts of terrorism. I think the Iraq War could be considered a classic example of it. Once again, very good intentions on the part of the people who wanted the Middle East to be, you know, liberated into modernity and all that. But it turned out to be a debacle, which is what it is. This is what I mean by saying that the civilized order that appeared in the world, you know, during the Cold War and the post-World War II period is basically unraveling. And we're entering a stage in which it becomes increasingly difficult to predict what's going to happen next and therefore impossible for rational actors to make rational policy about the future. For example, the Palestinian election, which Bush hailed as a triumph of democracy. The next day it turns out a landslide for Hamas, a recognized terrorist organization. Now, the question is, how many more triumphs of democracy can we afford?
You're saying that the normal course of order doesn't work anymore because the values of liberal democracy, which at least we in the West assumed virtually everyone around the world would share, it turns out they don't share. Many sectors of the world don't share.
Yeah, exactly. But it's more than that. It's that the values of liberal democracy are themselves contradictory. Another example is Iraq. We decided to have free and fair elections in Iraq, which is something that Jimmy Carter would have approved of. What turned out is that instead of each person voting his own conscience, et cetera, people voted along tribalistic lines. So the idea of bringing democracy to a country was supposed to be a liberalizing measure. It has turned out to be one in which secularism has diminished in Iraq. Women are less free. Gays are openly attacked. Men who shave off their beard are assassinated. Barbers who do it are killed. This is less liberal by civil rights standards than the regime before, even though it was a monstrous regime. In other words, we're kind of caught because promoting one liberal value turns out to come at the expense of another liberal value.
Why do you think the Islamic world in particular has resisted Western values so much? I mean, Pax Americana, as some people call it. Why has that been so threatening? And why has modernism really failed to take root in so much of the Islamic world?
Well, because the first thing to understand about Islam is that it was one of the great transformations of humankind. The spread of Islam, you know, the first 100 years of the Arab conquest was this incredible achievement. And the second thing you have to understand is that unlike most transient military conquests, this is one in which the religion sank its roots very deeply into every culture it came across. For example, like in the part of the Byzantine Empire that they overthrew, you know, this is entirely, you know, with some small exceptions, entirely a Christian society. And, you know, after 100 years or so, it was a completely Islamic society. And there is an inherent reason why Islam tends to encourage fanaticism. That is, if you go back to the birth of Islam, one of the problems that Muhammad had is how does he wield together a group of people who have always seen themselves as belonging to tribes and families? What he did was create essentially what I call an artificial tribe in which there were new routines, new institutions, new rituals, which applied to the community of the faithful and which separated them radically from their own tribe and clan. If Islam had not had this device, it would simply have, you know, just washed away within, you know, a generation or so. The fanaticism at the heart of Islam is structural, it's institutional, it's essential. It is not something that is incidental or byproduct. People had to fanatically be devoted to their rituals, to the Quran, to the belief in the Prophet, in order to separate from their tribal and clan background.
Couldn't you say the same thing about early Christianity, that there had to be a fanatical element for Christianity to become a world religion?
Well, yes. Listen, fanaticism is an essential, dialectically necessary part of the development of progress. Because if you have a group of people who feel that they have achieved a superior way of life, then unless they fanatically hold on to that way of life, they will simply be blended in with the general populace if they assimilate. One of the problems for us as liberals, fanatic is a bad word. We think of fanatic as, oh, this is terrible, this is terrible.
Or this is a crazy person.
This is a crazy person. So often the way we treat this situation is we call fanatics brainwashed chumps or something like that. We overlook the fact that these people intensely believe that they are right. We may abhor what they do. We may think they're terribly wrong. But to take away the element of their intense and passionate conviction, it leads us to real disaster, because in that case, we underestimate the challenge we're facing.
Well, this is a very sobering assessment. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me to.
Lee Harris is the author of The Suicide of Reason, Radical Islam's Threat to the West.
Hi, my name is Zia Sardar. I'm a writer and columnist on New Statesman, which is a weekly British magazine. Is there a clash of civilizations? Well, I think you need at least two civilizations to have a clash. When Gandhi was asked what did he thought of Western civilization, his answer was, it is a good idea. And I still believe the Western civilization is a good idea, but a culture that actually tortures people systematically, as we have seen in the Iraq affairs, I don't think that culture can claim to be civilized. On the other hand, I don't think there's much of a civilization on the Islamic side as well, because the great clash of civilization is supposed to be between Western civilization and Islamic civilization. And of course, in Islamic countries, they torture people just as easily.
What if we put aside that word civilization for a moment? Do you see a fundamental conflict between Islam and the West?
Well, there is a fundamental conflict between certain aspects of Islam and certain aspects of the West. For example, there is clearly a strand of Islam that we now recognize. I mean, people normally use the term Islamist to describe them, but we know what it is. It is the strand that comes from bin Laden, a strand that takes a very extremist view of Islam and that actually believes that their view of Islam should be imposed on others, not just the West, but also other Muslims as well. I mean, if we look at Al-Qaeda itself, for example, the most victims of Al-Qaeda are in Pakistan. I mean, suicide bombings in Pakistan is a regular occurrence. Hardly a week goes by where you don't have two or three suicide bombings. So, in fact, Al-Qaeda, in a sense, is also at war with the Muslim society of Pakistan. So there is a conflict, if you like, between that particular version of Islam and the West. But, of course, if you also have a West which believes that it can impose its own view on others, for example, its own view of democracy on others, then you have a different kind of extremism. So essentially, it's a clash of extremism, I would say.
How do you explain the mistrust, if not outright hostility between so many Muslims and so many people in the West? I mean, why is this such a problem right now in history?
People don't kind of just react in isolation. I mean, if you look at, for example, the last 50 years, the biggest source of distrust between, say, Muslims in general and Western countries is, of course, the question of Palestine. Systematically, Muslims have seen a particular kind of bias in favor of Israel and against the Palestinians. And this has been going on not just for the last 10, 20 years, but it's been going on for 50 years. It's a long history of kind of distrust. But also, Western policies have consistently undermined democracy in Muslim countries. Western leaders have said one thing and actually done something totally different. I mean, Iran is a very good example. If you look at why, in fact, if you look at Iran today, most young Iranians who do not have historic consciousness actually adore the West. They all want to dress like Americans. They listen to American music. They identify with American values. But those Iranians who do have historical consciousness remember that, in fact, the CIA and the United States was involved in removing a democratically elected prime minister from Iran and imposing the Shah, you know, who was basically a brutal dictator. America, for example, systematically says that we stand for democracy and human rights. We want to see Muslim countries as democratic countries.
Right.
Well, this is very good. So why has, for the last 50 years, the United States been supporting Saudi Arabia, which is a despotic absolutist monarchy? If you have a despotic monarchy that is basically there only because of the support of the United States, the monarchy in Saudi Arabia would not survive more than 2 weeks if it did not get the kind of support it gets from the United States. How are we going to have democracy in Saudi Arabia?
So you see this as a political conflict. I mean, if we want to try to strip down this sort of animosity between Muslim countries and Western countries to its primal source, it's a conflict over who gets to control whom and can the West impose its will on Islam, which is a very different analysis than you hear from a lot of quarters who see this as a conflict essentially between religion and secularism. You are not framing it in those terms.
No, I do not buy that analysis at all. Let us look at Turkey, for example. Turkey is a very good example. The party, ruling party that has actually won the election has been described as Islamist in the sense that this particular party has deep Islamic roots. It comes from, you know, Islamic activism. All their leaders come from Islamic activism. Yet this particular party is a deeply democratic party. It came into power first time through democracy. It has now been re-elected through democracy. It is the most successful government in Turkey's history, bar none. The economic achievements, the reform in terms of law have been absolutely amazing. Yeah. Now, who are the people on the other side who say that this Islamic party threatens secularism? Well, if you look at in context of Turkey, these are the people who actually identify with the military. When the Atatürk set up the secular republic, he made the military the guardian of Turkey's secularism. Now, there are lots of places where you see Islam, democracy, and secularism exist, you know, in perfect kind of harmony. Bangladesh is a good example. Malaysia is a good example. And now Indonesia is a good example, where you have a thriving democracy, a thriving secular state, but also a society that is deeply Islamic and that believes in the notion of Islam and politics. Let us establish one thing straight away. Muslims are no different from human beings anywhere else on the planet. Every Muslim wants to be just as free as every Western person. So what at the end it all boils down to is a question of opportunity. Space. Give us political space, the Muslims say, so we can create the kind of institutions and the kind of governance that we want. And in the end, it turns out that governance and those institutions they want to create are in fact no different than the ones that they exist in the West because, you know, these are universal institutions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Ziauddin Sardar is the author of What Do Muslims Believe and Why Do People Hate America?
What do you think? Are we caught in a clash of civilizations? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org/eastmeetswest. Coming up, the story of a Pakistani rock star who faced down the mullahs. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Clash of Civilizations, is part of the special series East Meets West, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Say your name. Say your name.
You're listening to the music of Janoon, a band that blends electric rock with Pakistani folk music, with lyrics inspired by Sufi poets and the Quran. Janoon has been called the U2 of Asia. In fact, Bono is one of the band's many fans, partly because of Janoon's campaign for peace in the conflict between Pakistan and India. Janoon is also enormously successful. They've sold 25 million albums. They've also waded into Pakistani politics. One song about government corruption got them banned in Pakistan for several years. The band's lead singer is Salman Ahmad, who grew up in both Pakistan and America. Ahmad is actually a trained medical doctor. Some years back, he gave up his stethoscope for his guitar. He says music, like medicine, has the power to heal. And Strange Champs wondered how Salman Ahmad came to love music.
I remember when I was a child, growing up in Lahore, Pakistan, my mother had this huge LP collection, which had Bollywood film music, Qawwali, which is Islamic devotional singing, Elvis and, you know, rock and roll, and even Irish and Jewish music, folk music. So I think just listening to those diverse styles of music planted many seeds. And you know, they only came into fruition when I moved to New York when I was 11 years old. And I saw Jimmy Page at a concert, and I decided that that's what I want to do, is to pick up the guitar.
Now, you're also a devout Sufi, which raises some interesting questions about the connection between religion and music. I know there are a lot of Islamic leaders who regard rock and roll as the devil's music. How do you tend to respond to that criticism?
Well, first, let me just say, when you say devout Sufi, I'm a believer, right? And you can put a label on it, whether it's Shia or Sunni or Sufi. But being a Muslim means to one who has surrendered, you know, to a higher power. And simple as that, I'm a Muslim. And in Islam, there is a minority view that Islam prohibits music. And I've done a lot of research. You know, I read the Quran. There's nothing in the Quran, the Muslim holy book, which says that music is banned. Since the Wahhabi influence, the Saudi Arabian influence on Islam, they fund madrasas, so they kind of really discourage music and poetry. But that's not the case in the majority of the Muslim world.
Now, you made this really interesting documentary a few years ago called The Rock Star and the Mullah. You want to tell us something about that?
Yeah, it was a PBS wide angle asked me that they wanted to do a film in Pakistan and would I be interested in presenting it. And I got on board because I said, you know, what I'd like to do is to go through the country and looking it through the prism of music. And in the north of Pakistan, where one of the religious parties had come into power, they had banned music in public places. Musicians couldn't perform. Some of them were being thrown into jail.
All music, not just rock and roll?
All music. In the end, there's a great sequence in that film where this one mullah that I'm having a conversation with, who had the more radical stances, you know, who said, no, you know, no music. Women should be at home and, you know, adulterers should be flogged. And then after 2 hours of saying no, 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 and I was about to leave, he said, I hope you're not angry with me. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, next time you go to the West, I want you to sing this. And he sang perfectly in key. You know, he sang this sort of devotional song, which once the cameras were off, I asked him, for 2.5 hours, you're saying, you know, this is prohibited. So he winked at me and he said, when I was a teenager, I used to be a singer and a dancer.
So what did you make of that?
Well, that people are in denial. There's a rigidity within the clergy and the mullahs, and also they're afraid of losing their gig. they see thousands and thousands of kids going to concerts and, you know, MTV Pakistan coming in and, you know, have private channels with all these young kids flocking to the music industry. And I think they fear that on the Friday sermon, they're going to lose their demographic. What we did in Junoon, what I tried to do was to take this popular form, which had always been associated with sort of just entertainment and, you know, love songs, and use Sufi poetry, which is traditional spiritual poetry, but at the same time very, very questioning, probing, and put that in a pop song. So that kind of, because it went out mass and it reached a younger audience, I think that created a lot of controversy.
Did you have some run-ins with Islamic fundamentalists in the early years?
Well, you know, interestingly, more political people rather than religious people, because the religious people didn't quite know what to make of us, because here we were singing the praise of Allah through guitars, drums. I remember this one concert, this was about 10 years ago. There was a lot of corruption during the time of Benazir Bhutto and Nawaz Sharif. Government corruption, mm-hmm. And I wrote this song called Accountability.
No sir, na janab, ehtisab, bas ehtisab.
And we did a free concert in Karachi to raise awareness about accountability, and there were, you know, 20,000 kids who were there. And what the politicians had done was they took the power away. In the middle of the show, you know, all the power went and you couldn't play. And the only place that they had power was this Islamic seminary. And so I jumped off the stage and I asked the mullah there, I said, you know, we're doing this concert to protest government corruption and, you know, we need power. So he looked at me and he said, aren't you the guy who sang the song Sa'i? And, you know, Sa'i is a metaphor for God. And I said, yes. So he told one of the students, give him a line. So it's a weird relationship, you know. Some mullahs actually feel that, you know, if you're singing devotional music, that's fine.
Mm. Wasn't that song, Accountability, isn't that the song that got your group actually banned in Pakistan for several years?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, pop stars or pop rock musicians were looked at like, you know, court jesters in the eyes of the establishment. Whenever there was like a national day, you know, they'd expect everybody to... the usual suspects to come and entertain, but to actually bite the hand that feeds you and say accountability. It was a turning point, I think, in pop history in Pakistan, that you could use dissent in pop music.
You know, one of the things that I think is so interesting about your music and about what you're saying is that themes of spirituality and of politics really run through your music and are all, you know, in some ways it's the same thing. And it's just very interesting. You sing a song about God, but at the same time you'll sing a song about government corruption that'll get you banned. Do you see a connection between these, spirituality and politics?
I don't see life in different boxes. I mean, in the Quran it says it's your duty to reveal the truth. I was influenced by the Beatles and, you know, John Lennon, and in the modern era, you know, U2, where they could balance both the spiritual and political comment, but do it in a way so it's not didactic, that it's entertainment. It's like an op-ed, you know? So mm-hmm. I always viewed that in a country, you know, like Pakistan, where the literacy rate is so low, pop culture is a really powerful tool to spread awareness.
Was your music especially affected by 9/11? I mean, I'm sure it was, and I know you've performed at several of the memorial concerts. But I'm wondering, did 9/11 make you question any part of your faith as a Muslim?
You know, 9/11 kind of really put a microscopic focus on Islam and the Muslim identity. And because I grew up both in Pakistan and in America, both of my worlds kind of collided with each other. I just felt that, you know, Islam was being hijacked by everybody. First, it was hijacked by the terrorists, you know, who flew the planes into the building. And then, you know, this whole idea of a clash of civilizations, that Islam is a religion which is naturally violent. And I looked at my life growing up in Rockland County, New York, where I was in a garage band with Jewish kids, with Christian kids, and there was never, you know, we didn't live in the caves. We were in mainstream society, and my parents, my mother's a very conservative Muslim, but never, you know, were we ever told that, you know, that you're different or you have to grow up different. So 9/11, I think first of all, I went inwards to study my faith better. And then I think the natural thing was to express it through music. So when I went back to Pakistan, I wrote some lines which I thought kind of take a dual perspective, both from the Muslim world and America. And we did this song called No More. That was sort of my reaction to it.
God and money take the blame. Suicidal video games. If all that lives is born to die, love remains, I wonder why.
No More is a song by the Pakistani rock group Janoon. The band's lead singer, Salman Ahmad, talked with N. Strange Champs. In a minute, we'll look back at the last great clash between East and West, the showdown between Communist China and Capitalist America. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Clash of Civilizations, is part of the special series East Meets West, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. The conflict between militant Islam and modern America looks so huge it seems like it could last for decades. But there was a time not so long ago when another conflict looked equally intractable. China, Red China, as it was known in the West, was the bitter enemy of anti-communist America, which is why Richard Nixon's historic trip to China in 1972 really did shake up the world.
It is a great privilege, Mr. Prime Minister, and our very distinguished guests from the People's Republic of China and the United States of America. I want to express my deep appreciation for the boundless and gracious hospitality which you have extended to us.
Nixon's trip to China was a turning point in East-West relations. It was the great triumph of Nixon's presidency, and it even inspired an opera. Margaret McMillan has written a book about Nixon's visit to China. It's called Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World.
It's one of those moments where you remember where you were, because it was such an unlikely and previously inconceivable spectacle to think that Nixon was there standing in Beijing in the Forbidden City on the Great Wall. It seemed so unlikely.
Was it really so radical?
Yes, it was. And I think that's why Nixon going to China has become a sort of catchphrase for a statesman doing something that is bold, represents a really decisive change in foreign policy. You could say that the time was right. I think some of the old anti-communist, particularly anti-Chinese communist fervor in the United States had died down. But I think it took Nixon to say, okay, I'm going to do it.
What was the relationship really like at that time? Because I think that may be the part that a lot of people don't remember very clearly. We had essentially the three superpowers, but China wasn't considered on quite the same level as the United States and the Soviet Union, was it?
No, China really was not considered a superpower at all, and that was partly because it was economically and militarily backward, but also because in the 60s it had essentially taken itself off the world stage. It had turned inwards, and the convulsions of the Cultural Revolution had really prevented it from playing any sort of part in the world. The other thing that I think is probably necessary to remind people is that really before Nixon began thinking the unthinkable, there was no relationship between the People's Republic of China and the United States, and there hadn't been one since 1949.
We had fought a war with them in Korea, although not directly, so there had been some contact during all that time. And the anti-communist feeling in the United States, as you point out, was strong, although beginning to wane, which is a curious thing at the time of the Vietnam War, that there should be an easing of that at a time when otherwise you'd think it would be growing.
I think what Americans were now beginning to be able to do was to distinguish between various sorts of communists. And it was quite clear that the Soviet Union and China, although they were both communist nations, had fallen out. It was very public. And in fact, in the summer of 1969, there were armed clashes along the common border. And I think the United States had also got used to dealing with the Soviet Union. And so going to China, to talking to another communist power, I think was no longer conceptually or intellectually as difficult as it might have been at the beginning of the 1950s.
Why would the Nixon administration be interested in having any relationship with China? What was in it for Richard Nixon?
Well, I think a number of things were in it for Richard Nixon. At a personal level, it was a very dramatic moment which helped to portray him as a world statesman on the world stage, which was something he very much wanted to do. And of course, 1972, the year he went to China, was an election year. But I think it was much more than any sort of personal desire on Nixon's part. I think what it was a recognition by Nixon that if the Americans could establish a relationship with China, it would put real pressure on the Soviet Union and really transform the nature of the Cold War, because the Soviets would suddenly have to start to think about another flank. It would also, or so Nixon hoped, help the United States to get out of Vietnam. In this, in fact, he was wrong, but what he thought was that the Chinese communists, being the sort of big brother of the North Vietnamese communists, would put pressure on the North Vietnamese to negotiate more seriously than they had been with the United States and enable the United States to get out of Vietnam.
Now, you've talked about what was in this for Nixon. What about for China? Was this a time when they were suddenly ready to step onto the world stage again?
Yes, I think they were. China had become dangerously isolated in the course of the 1960s. I mean, they were on bad terms with virtually all their neighbors. They'd fought a war with India at the beginning of the 60s. They had really no relationship with Japan or South Korea. They were on very bad terms indeed with the Soviet Union. In fact, so dangerously bad were they that the Chinese feared with very good reason that the Soviets were planning a sneak nuclear attack in the fall of 1969. And so I think for Mao, to save the revolution and to protect China, the idea of an opening to the United States began to seem more and more appealing.
Of course, there's also the question at this point of Taiwan, a question that still exists today and is nowhere near settled. Was part of the Chinese hope that meeting with Nixon, opening this discussion with the United States, would change their relationship with Taiwan?
Oh, it certainly was part of the Chinese hope. I mean, what the Americans, I think, didn't realize until they really started to talk to the Chinese was that Taiwan was absolutely central in Chinese thinking. I mean, from the Chinese point of view then and indeed now, the existence of Taiwan as an independent state out there in the Pacific represents an unfinished part of bringing China back into being a whole country again. And that's what they wanted. When they talked to the Americans, they made it perfectly clear that they wanted the United States to pull all of its troops out of Taiwan. They wanted the United States to abrogate its defensive treaty with Taiwan. They wanted the United States to cut diplomatic ties with Taiwan. They got part of that.
And it's interesting to look back on this, isn't it? Because the more you talk about it, the more you describe the things that each party brought to the table and the people who were involved, they came with certain expectations, only a few of which were met. And yet this sits as this extraordinary moment when all of a sudden things became possible.
But I think in a successful negotiation, neither side gets exactly what it wants. I mean, the success of a negotiation is in both sides getting some, so they feel at least content with what they've got, and the door is left open for further negotiations. And that's really what happened in 72. And what both countries got as a result of the Nixon visit was a Soviet Union that now had to think very carefully before it moved against one or the other.
We've talked about this as though it had these advantages, those advantages, this country wanted this, that country wanted the other. But how, in fact, did they bridge the gap? How did the discussions move forward that made it possible for this meeting to take place?
Well, it's a very good question, and it wasn't easy. I mean, if the Americans had simply said publicly to the Chinese, we want to talk, the Chinese would quite likely have spurned them or not regarded it as a serious offer and vice versa. And so to simply establish contact with the Chinese, and the initiative came from the American side, was a very delicate business. And it was done finally through highly secret channels, the most important of which was Pakistan, which was on good terms with both China and the United States. But it really was very difficult to do, and it took 2 years of very secret and very delicate negotiations.
Let's take just a moment to talk about the theater of this, if you will. What about the actual meeting itself of Nixon and Mao? We know no papers were signed, and in fact, I gather there really wasn't very much discussed. But it was theater of the first order.
Theater is part of international relations. Well, theater is part of human life. And the mere fact that Nixon had a meeting with Mao, and that it was a friendly meeting, and that both sides concluded that it had gone well, was very, very important. And what was very important about the Nixon visit were all the symbols. Zhou Enlai and Nixon toasting each other at a banquet. Nixon on the Great Wall expressing admiration for the wonders of Chinese civilization and the accomplishments of the Chinese. So the theatrics and the symbolism of the visit, I think, was perhaps as important as what was actually discussed.
And, of course, those are the images that we remember that helped to establish this as an event that, as you put it, changed the world. But what really has changed as a result of this trip? Is the world in a different place now than it would have been without this?
I think so. I mean, I think you could argue that the opening between the United States and China and the establishment of, by the end of the 1970s, a full relationship helped to bring about the end of the Cold War. It put a new sort of pressure on the Soviet Union. I think what that visit also did was establish a relationship where one might not have been established. I mean, it seems so obvious now, looking back, that the United States and China should have established a relationship. In some ways, you could say it seems equally obvious that the United States and Cuba should have a relationship, but they haven't. They haven't had one since the end of the 1950s. You could also argue, as a number of people are arguing, that it's pretty obvious that the United States and Iran should have some sort of relationship because they both have something at stake in the stability of the Middle East, and they could talk about that. But I don't think it's going to happen. And so I don't think just because the times are ripe for a change to occur, that change necessarily will happen. I think sometimes it takes human beings to make that come about.
Margaret McMillan. Her book is called Nixon and Mao, The Week That Changed the World. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Clash of Civilizations, is part of the special series East Meets West. The series was produced by, to the best of our knowledge, at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information on To the Best of Our Knowledge or this series, please go to our website at ttbook.org/eastmeetswest.
PRI, Public Radio International.